He weighed the possible advantage, the extreme gravity of the situation. And after a moment he said he should be honoured. Most happy. "Then let's recall the frigate and I'll send across all the coats we possess." The Surprise came running down the wind, rounded to outside the line, and lay there with her foretopsail to the mast, looking as easy and elegant as a thoroughbred. "Good-bye, Captain Muffet," said Jack, shaking his hand. "And I suppose we shall see one another again before the old gentleman's with us. But we are of one mind, I'm sure. And you must allow me to add that I am very happy to have such a colleague."
"Sir,"
said Captain Muffet with an iron grasp, "you do me altogether too much honour." The lively pleasure of being aboard his own ship again, her quick life and response after the heavy deliberation of the Indiaman, her uncluttered decks, a clean sweep fore and aft, the perfect familiarity of everything about her, including the remote sound of Stephen's cello somewhere below, improvising on a theme Jack knew well but couldn't name. The frigate moved up to the head of the line, and on his strangely thin quarter-deck, only the more vapid youngsters left, and the master, apart from Etheridge and Stourton, he listened to his first lieutenant's report of Lenoir's motions. The report confirmed his own impressions. The admiral had gathered his force, and his apparent delay was, in fact, an attempt at gaining the weather gauge and at making sure of what he was about before committing himself. "I dare say he'll put about as soon as ever he fetches our wake," he observed, "and then he'll move faster. But even so, I doubt he'll be up with us much before sunset." He gave directions for making free with all the officers' coats aboard, and walked over to the taffrail where Mr. White was standing alone, disconsolate and wan. "I believe, sir, this is your first taste of warfare," he said. "I'm afraid you must find it pretty wearisome, with no cabin and no proper meals."
"Oh, I don't mind that in the least, sir," cried the chaplain, "but I must confess that in my ignorance I had expected something more, shall I say, exciting. These slow, remote manoeuvres, this prolonged, anxious anticipation formed no part of my image of a battle. Drums and trumpets, banners, stirring exhortations, martial cries, a plunging into the thick of the fray, the shouting of captains. This, rather than interminable waiting in discomfort, in suspended animation, had been my uninformed idea. You'll not misunderstand me if I say I wonder you can stand the boredom."
"It is use, no doubt. War is nine parts boredom, and we grow used to it in the service. But the last hour makes up for all, believe me. I think you may be assured of some excitement tomorrow, or perhaps even this evening. No trumpets, I'm afraid, nor exhortations, but I shall do my best in the shouting line, and I dare say you'll find the guns dispel the tedium. You'll like that, I'm sure. It raises a man's spirits amazingly."
"Your remark is no doubt very just. And it reminds me of my duty. Would not a spiritual as well as a physical preparation be proper?"
"Why," said Jack, considering,
"we should all be most grateful, I'm sure, for a Te Deum when the business is done. But at this moment I fear it's not possible to rig church."
He'd served under blue light captains, and he'd gone into bloody action with psalms drifting in the wake, and he disliked it extremely. "But if it were possible," he went on, "and if I may say so without levity, I should pray for a swell, a really heavy swell. Mr. Church, signal, tack in succession, all hands about ship." He mounted the hammock netting to watch the brig that lay outside the line, where all the long file could see her. A great deal would depend on Braithwaite's promptness in repeating the signals. The hoist ran up. The signal gun fired to windward.
I shall give them a moment to brood over it. He said inwardly, paused until he saw the scurrying stop on the forecastle of the Alfred just astern, and then cried, "Ready-o! Helmsley!" This movement brought the Indiaman to the point where the surprise had turned, while the surprise on the opposite tack passed each in succession, the whole line describing a sharp follow-my-leader curve. And as they passed, he stared at each with the most concentrated attention. The Alfred, the Coots, each with one of his quartermasters aboard. In her zeal, the Coots ran her bowsprit over the Alfred's taffrail, but they fell apart with no more damage than hard words and a shrill piping in the Lascar tongue. The Wexford, a handsome ship in capital order. She could give the rest her main topsail and still keep her station. A fine, eager captain who had fought his way out of a cloud of Borneo pirates last year. Now the Lushington, with Pullings, standing next to Mr. Muffet on the quarterdeck. He could see his grin from here. And there were several other Royal Navy coats aboard her. Ganges, Exeter, and Abergavenny. She still had water butts on her deck. What was her captain thinking of? Glogue, a weak man and old. God, he thought, never let me outlive my wits. Now, a gap in the centre for the surprise. Addington, a flash, nasty ship. Bombay Castle, somewhat to leeward. Her boatswain and Old Reliable were still at work on the breechings of her guns. Camden. And there was Bowes, limping aft as fast as he could go, to move his hat as the surprise went by. He'd never made a man so happy as when he entrusted Camden's guns to the purser. Yet Bowes was not a bloody-minded man at all. Cumberland. A heavy, unweatherly lump, crowding sail to keep station. Hope, with another dismal old brute in command. Lukewarm, punctilious. Royal George, and she was a beauty. You could have sworn she was a post-ship. His second-best coat stood there on the quarter-deck, its epaulettes shining in the sun. Rather large for her captain, but he would do it no discredit. The best of them all after Muffet. He and Babington were laughing, side by side, abaft the davits. Dorset, with more European seamen than usual, but only a miserable tier of popguns. Ocean, a doubtful quantity. "Sir," said Starton, "Lenoir's putting about, if you please." "So he is," said Jack, glancing aft. "He's fetched our wake at last. It's time to take our station. Mr. Church, signal reduce sail. Mr. Hallaby, be so good as to place the ship between Addington and Abergavenny." Up until the present, Lenoir had been continually manoeuvring to gain the wind and to gather his forces, making short tacks, standing now towards the Indiaman, now from them. But he'd formed his line at last, and this movement was one of direct pursuit. While the surprise lay to, he turned his glass to the French squadron. Not that there was any need for a telescope to see their positions, for they were all hull up. It was the detail of their trim that would tell him what was going on in Lenoir's mind. What he saw gave him no comfort. The French ships were crowding sail as though they hadn't a care in the world. In the van, the Semillant was already throwing a fine bow wave. Close behind, Marengo was setting her royals. And although the Belle Poule lay quarter of a mile astern, she was drawing up. Then there was the Berceau. How she managed to spread so much canvas after the drubbing she'd received, he couldn't conceive. An astonishing feat. Very fine seaman aboard the Berceau. In the present position, with the Indiaman under easy sail on the starboard tack, with the wind 2 points free, and Lenoir 5 miles away, coming after them from the eastwards on the same tack,
Jack could delay the action by hauling his wind. Delay it until the morning, unless Lenoir chose to risk a night action. There was a good deal to be said for delay. Rest, food, greater preparation. And their sailing order was not what he could have wished. But, on the other hand, a bold front was the very essence of the thing. Lenoir must be made to believe that the China fleet had an escort. Not a powerful escort, perhaps, but strong enough to inflict serious damage with the help of the armed Indiamen if he pushed home his attack. As for the sailing order, there'd be too much risk of confusion if he changed it now. They weren't used to these manoeuvres. And in any case, once the melee began, once the smoke, din, and confusion of close action did away with the rigid discipline of the line, and with communication, those captains who really meant to lay their ships alongside an enemy would do so. The others would not. The tactics that he had agreed upon with Muffet, and that had been explained to the captains, were those of close, enveloping action. The line of battle to be maintained until the last moment, and then to double upon the French ships, to take them between two or even three broadsides, overwhelming them with numbers, however weak the fire of each company ship. If a regular doubling was not possible, then each captain was to use his judgment to bring about the same position. A cluster of ships round every Frenchman, cutting up his sails and rigging at the closest range. Now, after hours of reflection, he still thought this idea the best. Close range was essential to make the indifferent guns bite hard. And if he were Lenoir, he should very much dislike being surrounded, hampered and battered by a determined swarm. Above all, if some men of war were mingled with the Indiamen. His greatest dread, after the doubtful fighting qualities of the merchantmen, was that of a distant cannonade, with the heavy, well-pointed French guns hitting his ships from 1,000 yards. Lenoir vanished behind the foresail of the Addington as the Surprise glided into her place in the centre of the line. Jack looked up at the masthead and felt a sudden, overwhelming weariness. His mind was running clear and sharp, and the continual variation of the opposed forces presented itself as a hard, distinct point on a graph. But his arms and legs were drained of strength. "By God," he thought, "I'm growing old. Yesterday's brush and talking to all these people has knocked me up. But at least Lenoir is still older. If he comes on, maybe he'll make a blunder. God send he makes a blunder." "Bondon," he cried, "run up to the masthead and tell me how they bear." They bore 3 points on the quarter. 2.5 points on the quarter. Belpool had set her forestaysail, and she'd closed with the two-decker. They were coming up hand over fist. The hails followed one another at steady intervals, and all the time the sun sank in the west. When at last Bondon reported the Semillante at extreme random shot of the rear of the line, Jack said to the signal midshipman, "Mr. Lee, edge away 1 point and get the next hoists ready. Prepare to wear all together at the gun. Course southeast by east. Van engage to windward on coming up. Centre and rear to leeward." This was the aggressive manoeuvre of a commander eager to bring on a decisive action. Wearing would reverse the order of sailing and send the whole line fast and straight for the French squadron close-hauled on the opposite tack, a line that would divide on coming up and threaten to take them between two fires. It would throw away the advantage of the wind, but he dared not tack altogether. Too dangerous an evolution by far in close order. And even this simultaneous wearing was dangerous enough, although a few minutes of edging away would make it safer. Indeed, Lenoir might well take it as a mark of confidence.
Now they'd edged away from the wind. The line was slanting farther south with the wind just before the beam.
"Carry on, Mr. Lee," he said, and turned to watch the repeating brig. The signals ran up aboard her, brisk and clear.
"I must give the Indiamen time to make them out," he said, deliberately pacing to and fro. The slow match for the signal gun sent its acrid smoke across the deck, and he found his breath coming short. Everything, everything depended on this manoeuvre being carried out correctly. If they turned in a disordered heap, if there was irresolution, Lenoir would smoke his game, and in 5 minutes he'd be among them, firing both sides with his 36 and 24 pounders. Another turn. Another. "Fire," he said. "All hands wear ship." Up and down the line of orders echoed. The bosun's pipes shrilled out. The ships began their turn, bringing the wind aft, right astern, on the larboard quarter, on to the beam and beyond, the yards coming round, round, and harder round, until the whole line, with scarcely an irregularity, was close-hauled on the larboard tack, each having turned in its place, so that now the Ocean led and the Alfred brought up the rear. A beautifully executed evolution, almost faultless. "Mr. Lee, make more sail. Hoist colours. Blue, because Admiral Harvey in Bombay was a vice-admiral of the blue. The Surprise, being under Admiralty orders, wore the white. Handsome colours and imposing. But the speed of the line did not increase. Signal Ocean, make more sail. Repeat, Ocean, make more sail," cried Jack, "and give him two guns." Ahead of them now, and broad on the larboard bow, there was the French squadron in a rigid line, colours flying, the Admiral's flag at the mizzen. The two lines were drawing together at a combined speed of 14 knots. In less than 5 minutes they would be within range. Jack ran forward, and as he reached the forecastle, Lenoir fired a gun. But a blank gun, a signal gun. And its smoke had hardly cleared before the French ships hauled their wind, heading nor-nor-west and declining the engagement. Back on his quarterdeck, Jack signalled tack in succession, and the line came about stretching towards the setting sun. In the depths, the cello was still singing away, deep and meditative. And all at once the elusive name came to him. It was the Boccherini suite in D minor. He smiled, a great smile filled with many kinds of happiness. "Well, gentlemen," he said, "that was pretty creditable in the Indiaman, eh?
"I should scarcely have believed it, sir," said Starton. "Not a single ship fell foul of another. It was giving them time to edge away that did it, no doubt."
"Lenoir didn't care for it," said Etheridge, "but until the very last moment I didn't think he'd sheer off night action or no night action."
Harrowby said, "The company officers are a well-behaved set of men. Many of them are serious."
Jack laughed aloud. Out of piety or superstition, he wouldn't even formulate the thought he mistook the situation he has made his blunder, far less put it into words. He touched a belaying pin and said, "He'll spend the night plying to windward while we lie to. His people will be worn out for the morning action. Ours must get all the rest we can manage and food. Mr. Starton, since we've lost our purser, I must ask you to see to the serving out of the provisions. Let the men make a good, hearty supper. There are some hams at my storeroom. Where's my steward? Pass the word for here I am, sir, and have been a-standing by the bits this half-glass and more," said Killick in his disagreeable injured whine. "A-holding of this sanglewich and this here mug of wine."
The Burgundy went down more gratefully than any wine he'd ever drunk, strengthening his heart, dispelling weariness.
so there's to be no battle after all,"
said the chaplain, moving from the shadows and addressing either Etheridge or the master.
"They appear to be slanting off at a great pace. Can it be timidity? I've often heard that the French are great cowards."
"No, no, don't you believe it, Mr. White," said Jack. "They've tanned my hide many a time, I can tell you.
No, no. Lenoir is only reculing poor Mieux Sauté, as he would say.
You shall not be disappointed. I believe we may promise you a brisk cannonade in the morning. So perhaps you might be well advised to turn in directly and get all the sleep you can. I shall do the same once I've seen the captains." All that night they lay to, with stern lanterns and top lights right along the line, each watch in turn at quarters, and 50 night glasses trained on Admiral Lenoir's lights as he worked up to windward. In the middle watch, Jack woke for a few minutes to find the ship pitching heavily. His prayer had been answered, and a heavy swell was setting in from the south. He need not dread the Frenchman's distant fire. Accuracy, long range, and a calm sea were birds tarred with the same feather. Dawn broke calm, sweet and clear over the troubled sea, and it showed the French and British lines 3 miles apart. Lenoir had, of course, spent all the night in beating up, so that now he had the weather gauge without any sort of a doubt. Now he could bring on the action whenever he chose. He had the power, but didn't seem inclined to use it. His squadron backed and filled, rolling and pitching on the swell. After some time, the Semillante left her station, came down to reconnoitre within gunshot, and returned. Still the French hung aloof, lying there on the beam of the English line with their heads northwest, and the heat of the day increased. The swell from some distant southern tempest ran across the unvarying northeast monsoon, and every few minutes the sharp, choppy seas sent an agreeable spray flying over the Surprise's quarterdeck. "If we engage her from the leeward," observed Jack, with his eyes fixed on the Marengo, "she'll find it damned uncomfortable to open her lower ports." She carried her lower guns high, like most French line-of-battle ships. But even so, with her side pressed down by this fine breeze, and with such a sea running, her lower deck would be flooded. All the more so in that she was somewhat crank, somewhat inclined to lie over, no doubt from want of stores deep in her hold. If Lenoir could not use his lower tier, his heaviest guns, the match would be more nearly even. Was that the reason why he was lying there backing and filling, when he was master of the situation, with a convoy worth 6 millions under his lee? What was in his mind? Plain hesitation? Had he been painfully impressed by the sight of the British line lying to all night, a long string of lights, inviting action in the morning, instead of silently dispersing in the darkness, which they would surely have done if yesterday's bold advance had been a ruse? "Pipe the hands to breakfast," he said. "Mr. Church, be so good as to let Killick know that if my coffee is not on deck in 15 seconds, he will be crucified at noon. Doctor, a very good morning to you. Ain't it a pure day? Ah, here's the coffee at last. Will you take a cup? Did you sleep? What a capital thing it is to sleep." He had had 5 hours in his wool-lined well, and now new, vigorous life flowed through him. He knew he was committed to an extremely dangerous undertaking, but he also knew that he should either succeed or that he should fail creditably. It would be a near-run thing in either event, but he'd not launched himself, his ship, and 1,500 other men into a foolhardy enterprise. The anxiety was gone. One of the reasons for this was the new feeling right along the line of battle. The captains had handled their ships well, and they knew it. The success of their manoeuvre and Lenoir's retreat had done wonders for the fighting spirit of those who had been somewhat backward. And now there was a unanimity, a readiness to fall in with the plan of attack that delighted him. However,
He knew how early morning sprightliness could anger his friend, and he contented himself with walking up and down, balancing his coffee cup against the heavy motion of a ship hove to, and champing a ship's biscuit dipped in ghee. Breakfast was over, and still the French squadron made no move. "We must help him to make up his mind," said Jack. The signals ran up, the British line filled on the starboard tack, and stood away to the westward under topsails and courses alone. At once the frigate's motion became easier, a smooth, even glide. And at once the French ships in the distance wore round on the opposite tack, slanting down southwards for the Indiaman. "At last," said Jack. "Now just what will he do?" When he'd watched them long enough to be sure that this was not an idle move, but the certain beginning from which all things must follow, he said, "Stephen, it's time for you to go below. Mr. Stoughton, beat to quarters." The drum, more stirring even than a trumpet, volleyed and thundered. But there was nothing to be done. The surprise had long been stripped for battle, her yards puddened and slung with chains, splinter netting rigged, powder filled and waiting, shot of all kinds at hand, match smoking in little tubs along the deck. The men ran to their stations and stood or knelt there, gazing out over their guns at the enemy. The French were coming down under easy sail, the Marengo leading. It was not clear what they meant to do, but the general opinion among the older seamen was that they would presently wear round onto the same tack as the Indiaman, steer a parallel course, and engage the centre and van in the usual way, using their greater speed to pass along it. Whereas others thought Lenoir might cross their wake and haul up to engage from leeward, so that he could use his lower guns, now shut up tight behind their port lids, with green water dashing against them. At all events, they, and all the frigate's company, were convinced that the time of slow manoeuvring was over, that in a quarter of an hour the dust would begin to fly. And there was silence throughout the ship, a grave silence, not without anxiety, and an urgent longing for it to start. Jack was too much taken up with watching his line and with interpreting Lenoir's movements to feel much of this brooding impatience. But he, too, was eager for the moment of grappling and of certainty, for he knew very well that he was faced with a formidable opponent, capable of daring unusual tactics. Lenoir's next move took him by surprise, however. The Admiral, judging that the head of the long British line was sufficiently advanced for his purposes, and knowing that the Indiaman could neither tack nor sail at any great speed, suddenly crowded sail. It was a well-concerted manoeuvre. Every French ship, and even the brig, blossomed out in a great spread of white canvas. Royals appeared, stunsails stretched out like wings, doubling the breadth of the ships and giving them a great and menacing beauty as they ran down upon the merchantmen. For a moment he could understand neither their course nor their evolution. But then it came to him with instant conviction. "By God," he said, "he means to break the line. Lee, tack in succession, make all practicable sail." As the signal broke out, it became even more certain that this was so. Lenoir was setting his heavy ships straight at the gap between the Hope and the Cumberland, two of the weakest ships. He meant to pass through the line, cut off the rear, leave a ship or two to deal with what his fire had left, luff up, and range along the lee of the line, firing his full broadside. Jack snatched Stoughton's speaking trumpet, sprang to the taffrail, and hailed his next astern with all his force. "Addington, back your topsail. I'm tacking out of the line." Turning, he cried, "All hands about ship. Hard over. Hallaby, lay me athwart the Marengo's hawse." Now the long, hard training told. The frigate turned in a tight, smooth curve with never a check, moving faster and faster as they packed on sail after sail. She tore through the water with her lee chains deep in white foam, heading close-hauled for the point where her course would cut the Marengos. Somewhere short of the British line if this speed could be maintained. He must take her down and hold the Marengo until the van ships could follow him, could reach him and give the surprise their support. With her speed it was possible, so long as he lost no important spars. To be sure it meant running straight into Marengo's broadside, yet it might be done, particularly in such a sea. But if he did it, if he was not dismasted, how long could he hold her? How long would it take for the van to reach him? He dared not disrupt the line. The merchantman's safety depended entirely on its strength and unity and the mutual support of its combined fire in close order. Poised at the break of the quarterdeck, he checked the position once more. The surprise had already passed three ships, the Addington, Bombay Castle, and Camden, moving up in the opposite direction towards their turning point, and they were making sail. The gap had closed. On the port bow, a long mile away to the northeast, the Marengo, with white water breaking against her bows. On the port quarter, still a mile away, the Alfred and the Coots had made their turn, and they were setting to gallantsails. The Wexford was in stays, and it looked as though the eager Lushington might fall foul of her. He nodded. It could be done. Indeed, there was no choice. He jumped down the ladder and hurried along the gun crews, and he spoke to them with a particular friendliness, a kind of intimacy. They were old shipmates now. He knew each man, and he liked the greater part of them. They were to be sure not to waste a shot. To fire high for this spell on the upward roll. Ball, and then chain, as soon as it would fetch. The ship might get a bit of a drubbing as they ran down, but they were not to mind it. The Frenchman couldn't open his lower ports, and they should serve him out once they got snug athwart his bows. He knew they'd fire steady. Let them watch old Reliable. He'd never wasted a shot all this commission, and they were to mind their priming. Old Reliable winked his only eye and gave a chuckle. The first ranging shot from the Marengo plunged into the sea 100 yards out on the larboard beam, sending up a tall white plume torn away by the wind. Another closer and to starboard. A pause, and now the Marengo's side disappeared behind a white cloud of smoke spreading from her bows to her quarter. Four shots of the thundering broadside struck home, three hitting the frigate's bows and one her cathead. He looked at his watch, told his clerk to note down the time, and kept it in his hand as he paced up and down with Stourton at his side until the next great rippling crash. Far more accurate. White water leapt all round her, topmast high, so many 24-pound shots struck home that her hull rang again. Way was momentarily checked. She staggered. Holes appeared in her fore and mainsails, and a clutter of blocks fell onto the splinter netting over the waist. Just under 2 minutes, he observed. Indifferent brisk. The surprise took no more than 1 minute 20 seconds between broadsides. But thank God her lower ports are shut. Before Marengo fired the next, the frigate would be quarter of a mile nearer. The Semi-Aunt, Marengo's next astern, opened fire with her forward guns. He saw one ball travelling from him, racing astern, as he reached the taffrail in his ritual to and fro. A distinct ball with a kind of slight halo about it. "Mr. Stourton?" "The bow gun may fire." It would do no harm. It might do good even at this range, and the din would relieve the silent men. The 2 minutes were gone, some seconds passed, and the Marengo's careful, deliberate broadside came, hitting the surprise like a hammer, barely a shot astray.
and immediately after that 6 guns from the Semillant, all high and wide.
Sarton reported, "Spritsel yard gone in the sling, sir. The carpenter finds 3 foot in the well. He's plugging a couple of holes under the waterline, not very low."
As he spoke, the bow gun roared out, and the encouraging, heady smell of powder smoke came aft.
"Warm work, Mr. Sarton," said Jack, smiling. "But at least Semillant cannot reach us again. The angle's too narrow. When Marengo starts firing, Grape, let the men lie down at their guns."
Fine on the port bow, he could see the last of the Marengo's guns running out. They were waiting for the roll. He glanced round his sparse quarter-deck before he turned in his walk. Bondon and Carlo at the wheel, Harrowby behind them conning the ship. Stourton calling out an order at the Hanses. Sail trimmers to the foretopsail bowline. Over to leeward, the signal midshipman. Then Callow with his bandaged head to run messages. And young Nevin the clerk with his slate in his hand. Etheridge watching the Indiaman through his little pocket glass. All the marines, apart from the sentry at the hatchway, were scattered among the gun crews. The crash of the broadside and of the bow gun and of the 20-shot hitting her came in one breath, an extreme violence of noise. He saw the wheel disintegrate. Harrowby jerked backwards to the taffrail, cut in two. And forward there was a screaming. Instantly he bent to the speaking tube that led below, to the men posted at the relieving tackles that could take over from the wheel. "Below there! Does she steer?"
"Yes, sir."
"Thus, very well thus. Keep her dice, do you hear me?"
3 guns had been dismounted, and splinters, bits of carriage, bits of rail, booms, shattered boats littered the decks as far aft as the mainmast, together with scores of hammocks torn from their netting. The jib-boom lurched from side to side, its cap shot through. Cannonballs, scattered from their racks and garlands, rumbled about the heaving deck. But far more dangerous were the loose guns running free. Concentrated, lethal weight gone mad. He plunged into the disorder followed, few officers, little coordination, catching up a bloody hammock as he ran. 2 tons of metal, once the cherished larboard chaser, poised motionless on the top of the roll, ready to rush back across the deck and smash its way through the starboard side. He clapped the hammock under it and whipped a line round the swell of its muzzle, calling for men to make it fast to a stanchion. And as he called, a loose 36-pound shot ran crack against his ankle, bringing him down. Stourton was at the next, a carronade still in its carriage, trying to hold it with a handspike as it threatened to plunge down the fore hatchway and thence through the frigate's bottom. The combings round the hole yielded like cardboard. Then the followed pitch took off the strain. The gun rolled towards the bows, and as it gathered speed, they tripped it, throwing it over onto its side. But the same pitch, the same shift of slope, working upon the loose gun amidships under the gangway, sent it faster and faster through the confused group of men, each with his own notion of how to stop it, so that it ran full tilt against the side abaft the forechains, smashed through and plunged into the sea. Oh, for these officers! High discipline did away with the men's initiative, but those he had left were hard at their duty. Rattray out on the perilous bowsprit already with 2 of his mates, gammoning the jib-boom before it carried away. Etheridge, with 6 marines, tossing the balls over the side or securing them. Callow and his boat's crew heaving the wreckage of the launch, free of the guns. He darted a look at the Marengo. All but 2 of her guns were run out again. "Lie flat!" he roared. And for the space of the rising wave there was silence all along the deck, broken only by the wind, the racing water, and an odd ball grumbling down the gangway. The full broadside and the howl of Grape tearing over the deck. But too high. A little hurried. Rattray and his mates were still there, working with concentrated fury and bawling for 10 fathom of 2-inch rope and more handspikes. The Surprise was still on her headlong course, her way only slightly checked by the loss of her outer jib and the riddling of her sails. And now the rear Indiaman opened fire from 0.5 mile.
There were holes in the Marengo's fore topsails, and he doubted she'd get in another broadside before the surprise was so close on her bow that the broadside guns would no longer bear. Couldn't be trained far enough forward to reach her. If the Marengo yawed off her course to bring the surprise into her fire, then Lenoir's plan was defeated. At this speed, a yaw would carry the two-decker east of the unbroken line. He limped back to the quarter-deck, where young Nevin was on his hands and knees, being sick. "All's well, Bondon," he asked, kneeling to the tube. "Below there. Ease her half a point. Another half. Belay." She was steering heavy now.
"Prime, sir," said Bondon. "Just my left arm sprung. Carlo copped it." "Give me a hand with t'other, then," said Jack,
and they slid Harrowby over the taffrail. Away astern, beyond the splash of the body, six of the Indiamen were already round. They were coming down under a fine press of sail, but they were still a long way off. Wide on the port bow, the Marengo was almost within his reach at last. "Stand to your guns," he cried. "Hard forward! Don't waste a shot! Wait for it! Wait for it!"
5 foot water in the well, sir," said Stourton. Jack nodded.
"Half a point!" He called down the pipe again, and again the ghostly voice answered, "Half a point it is, sir." Heavy she might be, heavy she was, but unless she foundered in the next minute, he would hit the Marengo, hit her very, very hard. For as the surprise came closer to crossing the Marengo's bows, so her silent broadside would come into play at last, and at close range. Musketry crackling on the Marengo's forecastle. Her marines packed into her bows and foretop. Another 100 yards, and unless Marengo yawed, he would rake her. And if she did yaw, then there they would lie, broadside to broadside, and fight it out. "Mr. Stourton, some hands to clew up and to back the foretopsail. Callow, Lee, Church, jump along forward. Closer. Closer." The Marengo was still coming along with a splendid bow wave. The surprise was moving slower. She would cross the Marengo at something under 200 yards. And already she was so near the two-decker that the Indiaman had stopped firing from fear of hitting her. Still closer, for the full force of the blow. The crews crouched tense over their pointed guns, shifting them a trifle for the aim with a total concentration, indifferent to the musket balls. "Fire!" he said, as the upward roll began. The guns went off in a long roar, the smoke cleared, and there was the Marengo's head and forecastle swept clean, ropes dangling, a staysail flying wild. "Too low," he cried. "Pitch 'em up, pitch 'em up! Callow, Church, pitch 'em up!" There was no point in merely killing Frenchmen. It was rigging, spars, masts that counted, not the blood that now ran from the Marengo's bowscuppers, crimson against a streak of white. The grunting, furious work of running in, swabbing, loading, ramming, running out. And number 3, the fastest gun, fired first. "Clew up!" he shouted above the thunder. "Back foretopsail!" The surprise slowed, lost her way, and lay shrouded in her own smoke right athwart the Marengo's bows, hammering her as fast as ever the guns could fire. The third broadside merged into the fourth. The firing was continuous now, and Stourton and the midshipmen ran up and down the line, pointing, heaving, translating their captain's hoarse barks into directed fire, a tempest of chain. After their drubbing, the men were a little out of hand, and now they could serve the Frenchmen out, their fire was somewhat wild and often too low. But at this range not a shot flew wide. The powder boys ran, the cartridges came up in a racing stream, the gun crews cheered like maniacs, stripped to the waist, pouring with sweat, taking their sweet revenge, thumping it into her, cramming their guns to the muzzle. But it was too good to last. Through the smoke it was clear that Lenoir meant to run the surprise aboard. Run the small frigate bodily down or board her.
drop the forecourse. Fill fore topsail, he cried with the full force of his lungs, and down the tube, 2 points off. He must at all costs keep on the Marengo's bows and keep hitting her. She was a slaughterhouse followed, but nothing vital had yet carried away. The surprise forged on, in a sluggish, heavy turn, and the two-decker side came into view. They were opening their lower ports, running out the great 36-pounders in spite of the sea. One shift of a helm to bring them to bear, and the surprise would have the whole shattering broadside within pistol shot. Then they could clap the lower ports to, for she would be sunk. Etheridge, with 4 muskets and his servant to load them, was firing steadily at the Marengo's foretop, picking off any man who showed. 1/2 mile astern, the British van opened fire on the Semillant and Belle Poule, who had been reaching them this last 5 minutes. Smoke everywhere, and the thunder of the broadsides deadened the breeze. "Port! Port! Hard a port!" he called down the tube, and straightening, "Main corsair!" Where was her speed? Poor dear surprise. She could just keep ahead of the Marengo, but only by falling away from the wind so far that her guns couldn't bear and her stern was pointing at the Marengo's bows. Fire slackened, died away, and the men stared aft at the Marengo. 2 spokes of her wheel would bring the Frenchman's broadside round. Already they could see the double lines of muzzles projecting from their ports. Why didn't she yaw? Why was she signalling? A great bellowing of guns to starboard told them why. The Royal George, followed by the 2 ships astern of her, had left the line, the holy line, and they were coming up fast to engage the Marengo on the other side, while the van was closing in from the west, threatening to envelop him, the one manoeuvre that Lenoir dreaded. The Marengo hauled her wind, and her swing brought the frigate's guns into play again. They blazed out, and the 2-decker instantly replied with a ragged burst from her upper starboard guns, so close that her shot went high over the frigate's deck and the burning wads came aboard. So close that they could see the faces glaring from the ports a biscuit toss away. For a moment, the 2 ships lay broadside to broadside. Through a gap torn in the Marengo's quarterdeck bulwark, Jack saw the Admiral sitting on a chair. There was a grave expression on his face, and he was pointing at something aloft. Jack had often sat at his table, and he instantly recognized the characteristic sideways lift of his head. Now the Marengo's turn carried her farther still. Another burst from her poop carronades, and she was round, close-hauled, presenting her stern to a raking fire from the frigate's remaining guns. 2 more were dismounted, and 1 had burst, a fire that smashed in her stern gallery. Another broadside as she moved away, gathering speed, and a prodigious cheer as her crossjack yard came down, followed by her mizzen and topgallant mast. Then she was out of range. And the surprise, though desperately willing, could not come round nor move fast enough through the sea to bring her into reach again. The whole French line had worn together. They hauled close to the wind, passed between the converging lines of Indiamen, and stood on. "Mr. Lee," said Jack, "General Chase." It would not do. The Indiamen chased, cracking on until their skysails carried away. But still the French squadron had the heels of them. And when Lenoir tacked to the eastward, Jack recalled them. The Lushington was the first to reach him, and Captain Muffet came aboard. His red face, glorious with triumph, came up the side like a rising sun. But as he stepped onto the bloody quarter-deck, his look changed to shocked astonishment. "Oh, my God!" he cried, looking at the wreckage fore and aft. 7 guns dismantled,
four ports beat into one, the boats on the booms utterly destroyed, shattered spars everywhere, water pouring from her lee scuppers as the pumps brought it gushing up from below, tangled rope, splinters knee-deep in the waist, gaping holes in the bulwarks, fore and mainmast cut almost through in several places, 24-pound balls lodged deep.
My God, you've suffered terribly. I give you the joy of victory, he said, taking Jack's hand in both of his, but you have suffered most terribly. Your losses must be shocking, I'm afraid.
Jack was warm now and very tired. His foot hurt him abominably, swollen inside his boot.
Thank you, Captain, he said. He handled us roughly, and but for the George coming up so nobly, I believe he must have sunk us. But we lost very few men. Mr. Harrowby, alas, and two others, with a long score of wounded. But a light bill for such warm work, and we paid him back. Yes, yes, we paid him back, by God! 8 foot 3 inches of water in the well, if you please, sir, said the carpenter, and it gains on us.
Can I be of any use, sir? Cried Muffet.
Our carpenters, boatswains, hands to pump.
I should take it kindly if I might have my officers and men back, and any help you can spare.
She'll not swim another hour.
Instantly, sir, instantly, cried Muffet, starting to the side now very near the water.
Lord, what a battering, he said, pausing for the last look.
Fine, said Jack.
And where I shall replace all my gear this side of Bombay, I do not know. Not a spar in the ship. My comfort is that Lenoir is even worse.
Oh, as for masts, spars, boats, cordage, stores, the company will be delighted.
Oh, they'll think the world of you, sir, in Calcutta. Nothing too much, I do assure you. Your splendid action has certainly preserved the fleet, as I shall tell them. Yardarm to yardarm with a 74. May I give you a tow?
Jack's foot gave him a monstrous twinge.
No, sir, he said sharply. I will escort you to Calcutta, if you choose, since I presume you will not remain at sea with Lenoir abroad. But I will not be towed. Not while I have a mast standing.
Chapter 10 The company did think the world of him indeed. Fireworks, prodigious banquets, treasures of naval stores poured out, such kind attentions to the crew while the surprise was repairing that scarcely a man was sober or single from the day they dropped anchor to the day they weighed it. A sullen, brutal, debauched, and dissipated band.
This was gratitude expressed in food, in entertainment on the most lavish scale and oriental splendour, and in many, many speeches all couched in terms of unmixed praise. And it brought Jack into immediate contact with Richard Canning. At the very first official dinner he found Canning at his right, a Canning filled with affectionate admiration, who eagerly claimed acquaintance. Jack was astonished. He'd scarcely thought twice about Canning since Bombay, and since the engagement with Lenoir, not at all. He'd been perpetually busy nursing the poor, shattered, fainting surprise across the sea, even with a favourable wind and the devoted help of every Indiaman whose people could find footing aboard her. And Stephen, with a sick bay full and some delicate operations, including poor Bose's head, had barely exchanged a dozen unofficial words with him that might have brought Diana or Canning to his mind. But here was the man at his side, friendly, unreserved, and apparently unconscious of any call for reserve on either part, present to do him honour and indeed to propose his health, in a well-turned, knowledgeable, and really gratifying speech, a speech in which Sophia hovered, decently veiled, together with Captain Aubrey's imminent, lasting, and glorious happiness.
After the first stiffness and embarrassment, Jack found it impossible to dislike him, and he made little effort to do so, particularly as Stephen and he seemed so well together. Besides, any distance, any coldness on a public occasion would have been so marked, so graceless and so churlish, that he couldn't have brought himself to it even if the offence had been even greater and far more recent. It occurred to him that in all probability Canning had not the least notion of having cut him out long ago. Oh, so long ago. In another world. Banquets, receptions, a ball that he had to decline because that was the day they buried Bowes. And it was a week before he ever saw Canning in private. He was sitting at his desk in his cabin with his injured foot in a bucket of warm oil of sesame, writing to Sophie, "The sword of honour they have presented me with is a very handsome thing in the Indian taste, I believe, with a most flattering inscription. Indeed, if kind words were halfpence, I should be a nabob, and, oh, sweetheart, a married nabob. The company, the Parsi merchants and the insurers, have made up a splendid purse for the men that I am to distribute. But in their delicacy, when Canning was announced. "Beg him to step below," he said, placing a whale's tooth upon his letter against the fetid Hoogly breeze. "Mr. Canning, good morning to you, sir. Pray sit down. Forgive me for receiving you in this informal way, but Maturin will flay me if I rise up from my oil without leave. Civil inquiries for the foot. Vastly better, I thank you." And Canning said, "I've just pulled round the ship, and upon my word I don't know how you ever brought her in. I absolutely counted 47 great shot between what was left of your cutwater and the stump of the larboard cathead, and even more on the starboard bow. Just how did the Marengo lay?" Few landsmen would have had more than the briefest general account, but Canning had been to sea. He owned privateers, and he'd fought one of them in a spirited little action. Jack told him just how the Marengo lay, and led on by Canning's close, intelligent participation in every move, every shift of wind, he also told him how the Semillante and Belle Poule had lain, and how the gallant Berceau had tried to lay, drawing diagrams in oil of sesame on the tabletop. "Well," said Canning with a sigh, "I honour you, I'm sure. It was the completest thing. I would have given my right hand to be there. But then I've never been a lucky man, except perhaps in trade. Lord, Lord, how I wish I were a sailor and a great way from land." He looked down-spirited and old, but reviving, he said, "It was the completest thing. The Nelson touch." "Ah, no, sir, no," cried Jack. "There you mistake it. Nelson would have had Marengo. There was a moment when I almost thought we might. If that noble fellow Mackay and Royal George could only have brought up the rear a little faster, or if Lenoir had lingered but a minute to thump us again, the van would have been up, and we had him between two fires. And it was not to be. It was only a little brush, after all. Another indecisive action. And I dare say he's refitting in Batavia at this moment." Canning shook his head, smiling. "It was not altogether unsuccessful, however," he said. "A fleet worth 6 million of money has been saved. And the country, to say nothing of the company, would have been in a strange position if it had been lost. And that brings me to the purpose of my visit. I am come at the desire of my associates to find out, with the utmost tact and delicacy, how they may express their sense of your achievement in something more, shall I say, tangible, than addresses, mountains of Pilau, and indifferent Burgundy.
Something perhaps more negotiable, as we say in the city. I trust I do not offend you, sir.